So the third personification of evil, the guide lists as several things. He says it's the principle of confusion, distortion, half-truth, lie, and all the variations that may possibly exist in connection with it. So I, because it's easier to have a phrase to work with, we shorten this particular personification of evil to half-truth. But the half-truth includes confusion, distortion, and outright lie. The guide says it includes using truth where it does not belong, is not applicable, so that the truth subtly turns into a lie, yet cannot easily be traced as such, because the divine truth is pronounced and seems unassailable. So basically, the evil of half-truth is to use reason, but without respect for it, to act as if you're telling the truth, but having an underlying agenda.
Could you give some kind of example of that?
Uh-huh. Laugh with me on this one. How about politics in general? Okay.
What part of that's true?
Well, quite seriously, there is a lot of truth in what people are dealing with politically. They have numbers, they have facts, they have figures.
Uh-huh.
But more important than the numbers, facts, and figures is the interpretation of them. And that's where you have people who look at the same figures and suggest two radically different solutions. Now, the only way the same figures can come up with two radically different solutions is if you are weaving those figures into a larger agenda. So if your perspective, if your philosophy, and I'm going to simplify dramatically, and I'm trying very, very hard not to get into actual politics. If your belief system is that government should be small, then what you want to do is empower all the local entities and disempower the larger federal government. If you believe that only Daddy can take care of all of us, and that Daddy is represented by the great federal government, then you want to, if you only have a limited amount of money, you restrict it from the smaller entities, give it to the larger entities, and presume that you can find one solution fits all solutions. Repeated the word solution several times, but bear with me on this. But you can make, good people can make different arguments for the same situation using the same figures. And the reason for that is they have different perspectives and philosophies. Now, the trick is that you may not be willing to admit your agenda. That's where half-truth comes in. So you argue based on the numbers say this, but your solution is skewed to one side because you also wish to fill in the blank. Support farmers, support business, support whatever you want to do. The reason you're interpreting the figures in a certain way is because you have an agenda. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm trying to talk from about a benign use of this. But, of course, the less benign the use is, the more we get into straight evil. And so the evil of half-truth is that someone would take a fact and attempt to cloak personal greed with it by telling you, I'm doing this for your good, and I can prove it. I can give you figures. I can give you facts. I can tell you. When the truth is that alongside your good, they're going to make a fortune out of the deal. And this is where America is dealing with the reality of special interest groups. And it is not easy to figure out what is the best solution for everyone when different people's agendas run into each other. And the person who does not get funded is naturally going to fight for their own funding with every tool at their disposal. So this is an area where half-truths run rampant, because we do not necessarily have the time, the ability, or the access to the total range of facts that we may need to know what agendas are going on. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Another use for half-truth is, so I'm going to say now that half-truth is the evil that manifests most often with the emotion type. So keep in mind that the emotion type, more than anything else, they need to stay connected. That's paramount. Disconnection is death. So to an emotion type, if the truth would sever a relationship, then they've got to twist that truth. They've got to cloak it, hide it, water it down. They've got to do something to that. Because the truth is a very powerful weapon. By presenting the truth, people will take action upon that. So if I was going to say something that the probability was, if I said it, people would not like you anymore, you would do whatever it took to keep me from saying that. Or you might mount a campaign to discredit me. Or you might put up different facts that made you look good, so that by the time I presented my truth, it was not easy to tell who was being truthful and who was being dishonest, and it muddied the waters. So the other aspect of half-truth, remember, is distortion. I've lost my place here. There we go. Confusion, distortion, and lie. And all the variations that may possibly exist in connection with it. Every one of those is what I'm putting under the umbrella of half-truth. And half-truth holds a lack of respect that the truth alone will allow people to make their own decisions and work for the best, everyone's best interest. So this is a way where you want to take the truth and you want to slant it or skew it in a certain direction because you want a certain result and you're not willing to have an open forum discussion about it. And especially, you're not willing to let I'm trying to think of a specific example, and I have resisted this because you get into dangerous territory here. Because especially when talking about half-truths, I can present a story one way and somebody else simply thinks I'm full of it because they've heard a different version of the story. And that is exactly the danger of half-truth. When we're not all dealing with the same facts, or when the facts can be interpreted in different ways, and we are working under different philosophical agendas, then just because we have the same information does not mean we have the same understanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems like a lie is a lie, though. There's not any half-truth in a lie, is there?
Yes and no. So, I'll give you an example. I did find one hard fact. I was watching a PBS documentary on Ellis Island. And one of the officials that was in charge of Ellis Island during the last massive immigration wave in the early 1900s believed in eugenics. He believed that certain cultures were less intelligent than other cultures, and that these cultures could be defined by nations. So he believed that Eastern Europeans were less intelligent than West Europeans. They even believed that South Europeans, we think of Europe as one thing. It's like the guys next to the ocean, those Southern Europeans, they're not as smart as the guys that live in the ice. Okay? So he was eugenist. That's what he believed in. And he wanted to document this because he wanted to put forward a bill to prevent immigration or to close down immigration from the areas of, for the areas of Europe that he thought were diluting and polluting the American gene pool and tearing his country down. So he did some experiments and he tried to prove this, and his proof did not work. And they have evidence of this. They have his forms. He changed the evidence to support his theory, and then he published it. The people who read his report did not know that he had forged the documentation, that he had changed the evidence. So in 1928, in the same year, President Coolidge dedicated the Statue of Liberty with that fabulous plaque that says, "Give me your tired and poor." And in the same year was passed the National Origins Law, which restricted immigration specifically from those countries that the eugenicists considered to be less intelligent and therefore less desirable. Now, that's a long-winded explanation. But the man who forged or changed his data was probably not the worst person ever born on this planet. I'm guessing that he was a person who had such a deep belief in his truth that he simply believed the data wasn't sufficient. That he may have actually believed he was simply providing the correct answers that he was unable to find. And therefore, to him, the forged data may not have been a lie. He may have seen it as being expedient. It is our interpretation that determines whether we think something is a lie or not, even on the basis of sheer fact. And that is the power of the human mind to interpret, to deny. So all of you know, I presume, oh, that's a terrible statement. I think I better swallow that one back. I am assuming that most people who have done any level of self-development have an awareness of where they have lied to themselves. When you did that, did you say, "I think I'll lie to myself today. I think I'll harm someone or create distortion for the sheer fun and joy of it because I'm in the mood"? That's not my experience with people who have been in a time period of their life where they were unable to admit things to themselves. And so they found a different explanation. So we're not talking here about the kind of lie that can be easily disproven. We're talking here from a spiritual perspective where someone knows that there is a wrong and they consciously or unconsciously cover it up. Now, if it's conscious, you could say that that is a lie. But if it's unconscious, and it's not blatantly obvious, That's the half-truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I realize that some of this stuff is murky, but we're not talking about the easy stuff. Another example of where truth gets distorted a lot is, once again, using America as a focal point, and I say that because a lot of Australians listen to these recordings, and this is not their reality. Their judicial system and their government and their culture marches to a different drummer because of a different history. But the American judicial system allows people to claim that they're not guilty and put on a defense whether they're guilty of sin or not. There are other cultures where it is dishonorable to claim that you're not guilty when you are. That's a very, very important distinction. That in one system of justice, it is, we assume that you're going to try to get off, that you have the right to do that. And we do not necessarily attach dishonor to your hope that you can beat the rap or get a, you know, receive less than you should. Although things are changing. In another culture, it is considered dishonorable not to fess up and take your medicine. And there's more shame associated with a false not guilty plea than there is with a guilty plea. So I think that's important because a lot of the stuff that the guide is presenting, within our culture, we have biases. And just, on some level, those biases are also half-truths.
Well, those cultures like that must not have as many lawyers as we do.
That's probably true. And every culture is working through its own stuff, so they've got their stuff. It's just not our stuff. Now it sounds like a George Carlin routine. And again, that's a place where if you open your heart and you say, we're all human, isn't that interesting that they developed that way? What could I learn by looking at this culture? Instead of recoiling and saying, I don't understand those guys, and I think they're wrong. Civilizations as a whole do not develop upon major distortions. You'll have distortions within a culture, but you don't have right and wrong culture. And once a culture has some distortion in it, other distortions manifest because of that, and that's where we wind up with different ways of thinking and looking at issues. I'll give you an example. Having lived in Australia, been blessed with having lived there, I found a lot of stunning cultural differences in Australia. I remember they don't have an awful lot of murder and armed robberies. They don't shoot each other for fun. And I remember there was an armed robbery, and they shot one of the robbers shot someone. And the papers were just, the whole society went apoplectic because there was no reason for it. The person that was shot was not protesting. They were not trying to withhold the money. The robber simply shot them. And the culture did not comprehend that kind of inhumanity. We understand people robbing. That happens. But we do not understand hurting someone else for no purpose whatsoever. And I remember that the mother of the slain person got on national television and pleaded with the robber to turn themselves in so that the family could have closure. Now, please translate that onto American television. It doesn't work. We don't operate like that. They're not better. We're not worse. But we have different ways of dealing with justice, with human relations, it's a lot of things. So this is another example where I make a study of different cultures and philosophies. I am personally fascinated by this, so I have this head full of trivia that nobody cares about, and I try very hard not to bore people. But to me, what it does is it emphasizes that there are things that are optional in one culture that are perceived, that are not perceived as optional in a different culture. Don't want to go off too far on these things. So the last point that I wanted to go over was that if you take these personifications of evil and say, okay, now what do I do with this? I got this picture. What do I do? And the guide says, no one principle operates independently of the other two. Now, this is useful because once you find one, you're going to find fragments of all three. And as a learning experience, this can be a powerful way of seeing where a minor distortion really has the potential for evil. Even though someone might present it to you as this is just a minor thing, this is small, it's not important. But if that is accepted, what happens next? If one distortion or half-truth is accepted, where do you stop the next one and the next one and the next one? If one example of separation is accepted as okay, where do you draw the line? I'm a movie fan, and I don't remember which film it was, but I remember very, very clearly the statement. Come to think of it, I do remember. It was in Judgment at Nuremberg. And at the end of the film, in the Spencer Tracy, Burt Lancaster version, Burt Lancaster was playing a German judge, and Spencer Tracy was one of the judges on the court that found him guilty for war crimes. And Lancaster, the character Lancaster played, was trying to salvage his dignity. And he was trying to reach out to another human being, to another peer, another judge. And he said, I didn't know. I didn't know where it would go. And it was a very powerful scene for me, because what Spencer Tracy's character said was, you should have known what was going to happen the very first time you condemned someone as guilty whom you knew to be innocent. Now, what literature, art, film, theater, all the arts, what they give us is a glimpse at moments of human interaction that can resonate phenomenally through our lives, that can help us see our own denial. And even though I have nothing to do with any of that, I'm not a judge, I was never in a court, you know, in theory it means nothing to me, but I remember seeing this film as a child and being shaken by it, because I heard in that truth that the first time you deliberately lie or do something wrong that harms another human being, you open the door, you open the floodgates. Where do you stop if one instance is acceptable? So the guide says in the lecture, I will give an example of how this interaction of the three principles works. Confusion and distortion of reality, making a truth out of a lie, and a lie out of the truth. It can go both ways. So making a truth out of a lie and a lie out of the truth creates a numbness toward subliminal reality, toward the cosmic eternal aliveness that can be felt deep in the soul of any individual when there is truth and clarity. This numbness created out of confusion and chaos inevitably inflicts pain and suffering, as the lie must inflict pain and suffering. You may experiment with these three principles, starting with any one of them, most prevalent in an individual's or collective manifestation, and you will see that they must all coexist and reinforce one another. What I am suggesting is that in reading this lecture and getting an idea of how evil can personify into three types, three manifestations of separation, materialism, and half-truth. And then starting to look around you and seeing examples of where these personifications of evil can be seen is a process of educating yourself. It's a process of learning to discern, I wonder if that's true. Or, that sounds like a separation. That sounds like they're pointing at the other person and we're not working together anymore. Or, in terms of materialism, noticing where you are more influenced by somebody who is popular than someone who is not popular. Why does the word of someone who is popular, why is it more powerful than an ordinary person's statement? Now, sometimes it is because they are simply more gifted. Some people are able to speak in a way that resonates more strongly with more people. But if you look at examples of where you are drawn towards people who are validated, more so than people who aren't validated, surely you will find an example where you want to snuggle up with a validated person and you don't want to be around the equivalent of the unpopular kid. I cannot give you formulas for this. It is one of the things about path work that occasionally I get depressed about and find distressing, that it's not as easy to teach as it seems like other philosophies might be. Because only you know the truth. So I'm going to read this sentence again because it's very powerful. This is the example of how the interaction of three principles work, because what these couple of sentences talks about is that there is a vibrancy, there is an aliveness to truth, that when it is smeared or covered up or distorted, creates a numbness. And we all have the ability to discern truth. And especially when it's not seen by others, that's an important gift we can offer people. But it is difficult to do so when everybody else is nodding their head at something and you're shaking your head. It's not easy to figure out how to verbalize what your concern is. It takes some skill, it takes some time. Well, looking at these personifications of evil, becoming practiced at identifying them, not pointing your finger at them, but identifying them, being sensitive to how you manifest them in your own life, and therefore learning to open your heart and be inclusive to other people, to beware of proof substituting for divine truth, and where we skew things based on other agendas that we don't necessarily want to bring forward. When we can see where we do this, as well as where others do this, then when we reach out our hand to offer or strengthen divine truth, we are not pointing our finger or attacking or grabbing. We can offer a truth. What the guide is saying is that people can recognize divine truth It's not that hard. But there are periods of time when we are numbed by these principles of evil. And it's very difficult to see. So I'm going to read this again because the words strike me as powerful. Confusion and distortion of reality, making a truth out of a lie and a lie out of the truth, creates a numbness towards subliminal reality, toward the cosmic, eternal aliveness that can be felt deep in the soul of any individual when there is truth and clarity. This numbness, created out of confusion and chaos, inevitably inflicts pain and suffering, as the lie must inflict pain and suffering. You may experiment with these three principles, starting with any one of them most prevalent in an individual's or collective manifestation, and you will see that they must all coexist and reinforce one another. Now, it must be that my clown is coming to the surface, because I have just come up with a beautiful example of half-truth, and it is certainly not sacred. It has to do with television advertising from several years ago. And again, even as a child, I saw this commercial on television, and I was horrified because I immediately knew what they had done. And some of you may remember this commercial. I don't remember the exact razor ad or shaving cream that it was advertising. But they took a credit card. And they took a credit card. And with the product X, they drew the credit card upward on the man's face. And you could hear the beard stubble. And with the shaving cream that they were promoting, they took the credit card and moved from up to down. Now, my father had a heavy beard, and I knew how to kiss him and not get hurt. So I knew that you never moved upward after you kissed Dad. You always moved downward, or you got scrapes on your face. My father's beard was serious, especially at the end of the day. So from this little tiny experience as a child of not wanting razor burn or beard burn on my face, I watched this commercial and thought, son of a gun, you're cheating. Another place where you can see half-truth is the ads for liposuction and facelifts and wrinkle creams. Because, interestingly, the people are never wearing exactly the same clothing. They are never photographed at exactly the same proportion. The lighting is always different. So I hope that the, you know, part of me wants this to be comedy, because I hate to think of people deliberately lying to us. But they are certainly trying to put the best possible light on their product or the results that they can achieve, even going so far as to, in my world, I would call that cheating. I don't know if it qualifies as a lie, but perhaps it does. These are examples of where in your everyday life you can notice where there are half-truths. In terms of, what do they call them, testimonials. If you read between the lines of the testimonials, you can wonder, did this person get paid? Are they advocating this product because they got paid? Or are they advocating the product because it genuinely works? It's very difficult to know. And again, in terms of separation, any commercial advertising that makes you feel superior to someone else in a very, very tiny way is encouraging separation. So, it's been an hour and a half. That's usually quite enough for people. Are there any questions or areas that you'd like to explore?
I might ask a question a little bit further about this judgment thing with regard to how that is a separation. In fact, all three of those parts there, but on a very serious subject, without mentioning that subject, someone makes a judgment, a friend of yours makes a judgment about somebody else,
mm-hmm.
and you notice that as a judgment, or you feel that you judge it's a judgment.
Okay.
And then how do you approach that subject in a positive way without it being received as a negative judgment against that person? You know, if you feel that let me be more specific then about someone made a judgment about someone having an abortion and severed ties with that person as a friend,
mm-hmm.
because of that. And it seemed to me, and that person said, the response was, you seem like a very cold person. But that person, from that person's viewpoint, it was a judgment that she had done something very sinful, you know,
mm-hmm.
or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me that there was something to be said about that was an expression of coldness in that case. So I didn't say anything one way or another, and I don't know whether to or not, or whether I should or whatever. But it seemed to me that that's a point that's very serious, and you have serious things that come up all the time like that that we don't address fully.
Life is wonderfully made up of such small moments. It's almost nice that not everything we do creates a nuclear war. In other words, there are times where not saying something can get people killed, where it can start a series of events that creates great harm and great suffering. But for most of us, our lives are made up of very small moments that involve only us and some relationships with others. And yet these moments are just as important. So what you should do, of course, is something that you will have to determine.
Right.
But the first thing that you've already done is you have questioned not saying something. That is a first step. To realize that you're not in complete agreement or that you are disturbed. What you can do is to examine more fully in yourself what disturbs you about this.
Say that again.
What you can examine is what disturbs you about this. And here's how complicated life is. The incident by itself, you could see as a point in space. Okay? But the actual reality of human beings is they are moving in context. This person has a religious, a moral, a philosophical view of life. It would be important to know if this person was congruent with that philosophy or incongruent in this moment. In other words, we can be disturbed because we're hearing someone flip-flop around. They're not being congruent to their own belief system. Secondly, we can be disturbed because we have actually come into association with this person for all the wrong reasons. And what happens in human interaction is that in one moment of time, we suddenly grasp that we have made friends with someone that we don't like or respect. That is a possibility. Or, while you may have respected and admired and liked them when you started a relationship, things may have evolved and gone on to the point where distance has opened up between you. And when someone makes a statement, you realize that you are no longer empathetic to their point of view. So in other words, you could be disturbed by this because you remained silent, but you could also be disturbed by this because this is not the first time you've been silent. This is just a larger emotional place. And that you have actually disagreed with this person in 100 other times and places, but not felt it as deeply as you feel it now. What I am suggesting is that the guide asks us to take responsibility for the 100 times we have said yes when that was not in complete truth. Rather than finding one moment and saying, oh, on this occasion you're dead wrong and I just can't agree with you and we must part company, or I must bluster and argue with you, or I must suddenly take you to task because it has surfaced and the truth is that there were many, many other discussions I should have had, but I had not had those discussions. So what I am describing is it is important to figure out what actually occurred. And what do your feelings represent? And if it is, for instance, a simple fact that this person feels that they are taking a cold and unempathetic view of someone, their life history may have led them to this place of perception, and arguing or disagreeing with somebody isn't necessarily going to be fruitful. But understanding better somebody's point of view and opening our heart to them and hearing them and presenting our own point of view without necessarily saying you're wrong may allow this person to hear another point of view in a non-judgmental way that may resonate with them in ways you can't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably closest to the... it seems like because of all the other things that this person has said and done that I'm aware of, that seemed suddenly out of context, you know, of
mm-hmm.
how they are or how that person is.
And
maybe
we
just
do that.
Maybe something needs, I just had the feeling maybe there needs to be some kind of point made of it, and there might be a kind of a blind spot, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm suggesting is that your truth shared with love, no matter how it is received, is still important.
Uh-huh.
Let me put it this way. Most of us have an experience of having had a teacher in our primary school years who deeply influenced our lives. But at the time, we were kids, and we may not have realized what was happening. It may have been something that grew in us over the years. So the person who's teaching primary kids, you can influence somebody's, you can influence the rest of their lives by how you behave in a classroom. But you don't necessarily know that. All you can do is do your best. The same thing can be true in friendships. That even if you offer your truth to a friend as non-judgmentally as you are capable of doing, even if they go off in a huff and they're very insulted, you don't know the full truth of whether or not they were able to receive you.
Mm-hmm.
that someone can walk off in a huff because they are frightened. That they feel they may not have been completely in truth, and that you have uncovered their coldness. And being unable to say, I guess that was a little bit cold, they may go into defense and want to sever from you. But that does not mean they didn't hear you. In fact, it can mean that they heard you very, very deeply. But if you offer it within defense, with any aspect of, I think we're talking more about defense here than evil, okay? But any separation from someone, any yuck, you know, gosh, that sounds terrible, you're very cruel, aren't you, is separation. Any demand that they prove their point is materialism. And any attempt to gloss it over or disguise it is half-truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm suggesting. If you're focusing on a lecture and trying to learn some points, that's really all I'm trying to offer in this tutorial, is to bring out these three points and show where they might exist in the real world and have people... My goal is to have people go out and practice identifying them so that you have more awareness that it's not just politeness, it's half-truth. And if we all became more aware of that and we did less half-truth and less demand for proof and less separation, that would be a massive change on the planet. So interestingly, for all the joking about materialism and numbers improving, the guide very often says, and his number, I find it interesting, his number keeps changing. Again, I'm a little bit of a reason type. So if the guide said, if 7.5% of people changed, we'd be better off, I'd notice the 7.5%. And then later he says 8%. Another place he says 10%. Another place he says 2%. And part of me is saying, would you just give me a number? But that's silly. But my point is that in the lectures, the guide says, you really have no way of knowing the power of truth. That to some extent, our task is to put it forward as best we can. And then to come back and improve ourselves and attempt to transform our own evil and put it forward again. And depending on which lecture you read and which percentage you read, if 5 or 10% of the people on this planet lived more open, honest lives with less separation, we would not be dealing with some of the issues that we're dealing with today on this planet. 10%. Even 5%. So to get around to the example that you bring up, and I appreciate real-life examples because that's actually where we have to work. If someone tells you something and it feels cold or shocking or distant, there may be truth in that. The person may be traumatized by the very event that they are relating. And rather than wanting to be cold or cruel about it, that may be a reaction on their part to protect the tender feelings that they may have about the situation. That's the paradox of who we are as people.
Well, not necessarily about the situation, but about their own circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm. So, are there any other questions at this point?
No, thanks. That's a good... I'm glad I asked you about that.
Cool. So, in regular working together, that's all we do, is work on personal, individual questions. It's just harder in a teleconference format.
Right.
And again, the idea is to just go through the lecture and pick up points and try to enliven them and make them a little bit more salient and recognizable. And the work is, of course, always the personal work you do on your own. So are there any other questions by anyone else? Okay, well, I thank you very much for being present and for joining me today. And there will be another one in 2 weeks, and I'm going to stay on the triad structure. We'll be talking about love, power, and serenity, which is a more the defensive system of the reason, will, and emotion types, because it tends to help people to get these things pictured clearly in their mind. So thank you again. Appreciate your participation.
Thanks, Jan.
Hope you will join us.
Thank you, Jan.
No worries, mates. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.